So this afternoon I'm here at the first day of the Melbourne Writers Festival, and I'm speaking to Dr. Nasia Barfin. And thank you very much for spending time with us this afternoon.
Not a problem, Nasia, at all.
Thank you. Now, you're a senior lecturer in the School of Media, Film and Journalism at Monash University.
That's correct.
And I think you were born in Indonesia?
Yes, I was born in Jakarta. I moved to Australia when I was about 2 years old.
Okay.
So my dad initially settled in Perth, and then decided Melbourne was more approachable,
yes.
I suppose, more suitable for a family.
Sure.
And then my mum and I came over. My mum was pregnant with my little sister. I was about 2 years old. That would have been about 1979.
Great. Okay.
And have been in Melbourne ever since.
And this afternoon you're about to take part in a forum called The Right to Belong at the Writers' Festival. The question is, what's the future of multiculturalism in Victoria? And sort of talking about how do we make Australia as inclusive as possible. So I suppose, speaking of inclusivity, what challenges have you faced living in Australia as a Muslim woman?
I think a lot of these challenges have to do with the fact that I'm in a field that isn't traditionally associated with Muslims.
Mm.
So prior to teaching journalism, I was a journalist. Having said that, I was in radio, so there wasn't a lot of visual representation of Muslims back then in my particular field. And I found that it was a field that I really enjoyed because I was curious about, you know, telling people stories and so on. And I did work in public radio, and I understand from former students and colleagues, people I went to uni with, that commercial media is a completely different, completely different kettle of fish. So certainly you'd be hard pressed to find a whole heap of diversity in some commercial newsrooms, but they at least paid, there was a nod to it in the places that I worked. SBS,
so
its whole
SBS.
Focus.
Yeah,
SBS Radio's whole focus was representing the diverse voices of Australia.
Mm.
And the ABC tried, they really did. I guess the issues there were not just that the media wasn't considered a viable career option for people of Muslim backgrounds for understandable reasons. They felt the media hated them, which is not true, but they felt that they got a bad rap from the media.
Mm.
And so the second reason was, of course, that a lot of these people were first and second generation migrants.
Yeah.
So they were trying to establish themselves in Australia, worried about putting food on the table.
Mm.
So they wanted their kids to succeed in fields, I guess, which were more economically sustainable. So they thought, oh, journalism, why on earth would my kid want to study that, want to become a journalist? So of course you get all the children of Muslim backgrounds becoming doctors, lawyers, engineers, accountants, anywhere that offered sort of a decent step up from the factories or whatever that their parents worked in. And so on the one hand, you didn't have a huge influx of people from diverse backgrounds wanting to enter the field.
Mm.
And on the second hand, you had commercial news organisations maybe a bit reticent. And that's slowly changing, but that was certainly one of the big challenges. People didn't assume, firstly, Muslims, and secondly, Muslim women who looked like Muslim women, because I choose to wear a headscarf.
Mm.
Some people don't,
right.
And people don't expect someone like that to be in the field that I'm in. Although, like I said, happily, that's changing.
Mm-hmm. So, do you write for Indonesian media as well?
I used to.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff I do now is freelance. So
yes.
I work full time at Monash teaching journalism. I do write freelance pieces for a whole range of publications. My work has appeared in places like the Jakarta Post, the Jakarta Globe, a couple of other Southeast Asian papers, as well as freelance articles here. I still pitch occasionally to Radio National, to those sorts of places. And of course I do a lot of academic writing.
And because today's forum is really, around the future of multiculturalism, I guess that's sort of the issue that, is going to be to the forefront, really, for discussion this afternoon. And I noticed, sort of connected with that, just this week, somebody from Yorba University, from Monash, Andrew Marcus, did quite a long report on attitudes, particularly to multiculturalism and diversity in Australia. And he found that Australian-born males, I think, are more likely to reject cultural diversity, and Australian-born people are six times more likely to think that there's too many migrants compared with people who perhaps weren't born in Australia. It must be indicative of the situation, is it? What can you sort of add to that?
I think that he is doing this work as part of the Scanlon Foundation, who are a philanthropic organisation who work in this space. And these are, I'd say they're concerning, but not to the extent that we, I think, need to start taking concrete steps to prevent, for instance, say journalists or people in the media from, I wouldn't argue for stricter controls on freedom of speech, for example. We have to bear in mind that a lot of these survey results are across Australia, so they're national. Now, I found that in different states, feelings towards multiculturalism and diversity are markedly different. And walking around, say, somewhere like Perth or somewhere like the Gold Coast, I actually feel it. I feel that in Melbourne, it's far more welcoming.
Yeah.
I did my PhD in Sydney, and there was such a divisive feel about that city.
Really?
In terms of...
Surprising.
If you lived in the North Shore, particularly in the area of sport, which I'm interested in, you know, if you lived in the, on the North Shore, you followed certain teams, you hung around with certain people, you really didn't go beyond your circle, your familiar circle. And similarly, if you lived in the West, it was very, you know, it was almost like a trip to the centre of town. It was like another world or another planet. You do have your ethnic enclaves in Melbourne, and that's what makes Melbourne great. You know, if you want good Vietnamese food, you know, you go to Footscray, that sort of thing. But by the same token, I don't feel it's as ghettoised, I guess, as Sydney, or as... I don't feel that those silos are as strong in Melbourne. So you have your pockets of ethnic communities, but certainly... You know, no one's going to feel out of place or threatened if they walk in a particularly in a place that's dominated by one particular culture. Certainly, people have discovered how awesome it is, for instance, to go up Sydney Road and discover fantastic Lebanese food. So that sort of thing. Areas like Footscray are becoming far more appealing in terms of apartments and things for young couples. And I've never felt that Melbourne has been as as compartmentalized, as divided as other places. So while results like the report by the Scanlon Foundation released yesterday are concerning, I have faith in Victoria, I have faith in Melbourne, and I feel that we've had such a long and well-established multicultural society that we can overcome these sorts of challenges that, you know, we know are sweeping the globe, that we know are happening in places like Europe, in the US with the rise and imminent, you know, self-implosion of Donald Trump. We know that these trends are happening. I just feel in Victoria we've got such a strong multicultural society that if our leaders take the right steps, they'll filter down to the media, to, you know, general civil
general
society.
Yeah.
And we'll be able to overcome that and continue to sort of exist as a harmonious society as we have for, you know, for decades.
So, And one of the areas of your research is cyber racism. And so it's just looking at sort of the internet and social media in general, there's been many sort of advantages in social media in terms of sort of diversity and then as a tool for tolerance, I suppose. But do you think at the same time there are disadvantages that it has actually unleashed a wave of intolerance and given racists perhaps a wider platform to express themselves?
John, I think you've summarised all the emerging research in this area very, very
accidentally.
Well. Accidentally. Yes, you've done it very well. Yeah, on the one hand, what social media does is level the playing field, and so it allows people who never had a voice through the media to be able to build a presence. It allows people from different communities to sort of gather together, lobby together online. One of my PhD students over in Monash is looking at how particularly Bangladeshi women use social media to gather and to, you know, to organise community events, that sort of thing, to lobby, to discuss the news. It's been a benefit to communities. But the second thing that you've mentioned, yes, unfortunately, the anonymity of certain parts of the internet allows people to say things without, without accountability, because they feel that it can't be traced back to their identities.
Yeah.
Now,
well, we've seen some repercussions of that too, haven't we?
Yeah. Absolutely. And so now people are beginning to see that you can be held accountable. And it's a big challenge for the big social media networks, for Facebook, Twitter. It's a huge challenge for them in terms of how to deal with this without infringing on people's right to freedom of expression.
Sort of a party like the Party for Freedom, you know, seems to have sort of been moving out of the cyber world into the real world a bit too.
Yeah.
Does it sort of give them confidence to do that? That sort of when they've got a status on social media.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point that you're raising there, John, because the internet can exacerbate views which are really just fringe views.
Yes, yes.
Certainly you would think by looking at the social media presences of groups like the United Patriots Front or Reclaim Australia, certainly they seem to have far more supporters than they might actually have in real life. And so it sort of amplifies their voices. Absolutely. Where if you can imagine before the internet, they would have been relegated to perhaps, you know, one letter in the paper, and other people would read that paper and would read that letter and go, that's a bit odd, that's not the Australia that I stand for.
Yeah.
Whereas now it seems to have encouraged people to come out into the open. But so again, I think there's a tipping point. So you see with Donald Trump, the crazy has sort of hit a particular point. And so now you see the rallies that that were previously packed with people beginning to thin out. And I think that's what's happening to a large extent here in Melbourne.
So you probably have some ideas too on just assessing the power of social media in general. But do you think, I think you said somewhere in one of your articles that the role of social media may be overstated in civil action?
Yeah, I think so. As I said, it does tend to exacerbate voices, but it is also interesting to sort of have a look at questions like, would groups like, for instance, ISIS, would they exist without the recruiting potential of services like Twitter?
Yeah.
You know, I guess it goes both ways. They can be used to both exacerbate the voices of people who would wish harm on our multicultural society, but they're also dangerous ways for people to reach out to those who feel marginalised and who feel isolated. And it's an easy tool, I guess, for those outside of Australia who want to wish harm on a country like Australia, to be able to reach young people who may sense that their identities are under threat. And it's a very easy way for them to sort of go, well, have a look at how much this country hates Muslims. Why don't you sacrifice yourself for the greater good of Islam and, you know, do something nasty in Australia? So I think the best way to get around that is to be as inclusive as possible and to say to these young men, you've got a place in this country. You know, there's a place for you socially, there's a place for you in sport, there's a place for you in terms of a better economic situation for your family. There's a space for you in terms of getting a better education. There's a future here for your kids. That would make them, I guess, less susceptible to that sort of internet recruiting that we see ISIS use, unfortunately, quite successfully.
You've probably got some ideas too, just on sort of the power of the internet in general and social media. Do you think a lot of those campaigns can be a bit ineffectual? There can be a bit of fatigue sort of coming in because, you know, there's another campaign letter to sign, so you sign that and you feel good and, you know, you move on to the next one. Does that sort of have its day a bit, do you think, that sort of campaigning?
It's certainly interesting if you see the reaction to things like the little boy from Syria who was washed ashore on a Turkish beach. I mean, it's almost as if that spurred the world into action, but then sort of all that attention after that became viral sort of receded. That's always the danger with internet campaigns. If they're not sustained in the real world, then people's attention spans reduce. And as flailing as it is, ISIS know this. And so we saw for a while there, with each video that they released, it became progressively more shocking because they know the attention span of people. You know, there's something called compassion fatigue. And, you know, we get progressively more immune to these sorts of things. But happily, from all accounts, ISIS is not, you know, winning ground. And that's something, too, that we have to pay attention to, because as they lose power in a geopolitical sense, it's possible that they may stress more the power of the internet to recruit people to do things similar to lone wolf attacks. And so as they lose power, they lose towns, they lose, you know, control of oil fields, which give them money, that sort of thing. They might look towards the internet to find people who are willing to do bad things.
Yes, yeah. Something you said sort of moves into the sort of area of sport, which is your other sort of one of your other areas of interest. And I understand you're an AFL Multicultural Community Ambassador. Now, what is a AFL Multicultural Community Ambassador do?
Okay, so the AFL recognise that with the growth in culturally and linguistically diverse communities in Australia, they needed to reach out to those communities. Or as the previous CEO of the AFL said once in an address to the National Press Club, he said, how do we make our game relevant to a 10-year-old Muslim girl? And so he thought, you know, that sort of set in process something which the current CEO, Gillon McLachlan, is also continuing. So under the leadership of these guys, what the AFL has been doing is trying to reach out to multicultural communities. And so they have multicultural ambassadors among the players, and then they have multicultural ambassadors among the community. And so my role, for instance, is to link up AFL with young Indonesians or young Muslims. Mm. And that involves basically working with a club that you're assigned to. I live in Arden Street, so I was assigned to the North Melbourne Football Club, which is good because they're my club anyway.
Yeah.
And so they work a lot with groups like the Scanlon Foundation. They try and target the diverse communities that live near their area, and they open up the club for things like study support groups. They have scholarships. They've got you know, trips to the footy for new migrants, for people new to Australia, and they do a lot of work in that space. So that's what my role entails, and that's what the role of the other people who are multicultural community ambassadors with the AFL, that's what they do. So whatever community that they work with, I've got some very close friends who are from the Cantonese community, who are also ambassadors, from the Sikh, from various Indian communities, and they do exactly the same thing. You know, they try and get their mates along to the footy. They try and some of them coach junior teams. They basically try and get people involved in AFL.
Mm-hmm. I think you sort of hinted earlier something about that sort of connection between sport and perhaps young people who perhaps, as a sort of way of sort of stopping them from moving into crime or even, you know, terrorism. Do you see a role for sport in that?
It's incredibly effective because sport is such a large part of life in Australia, such a huge part of it. And it's almost like a language that people speak. And so you get, you know, you get your first job and people are standing around the water cooler on a Monday. And what are they talking about? They're talking about footy, you know. And so if you're able to speak that language, then you feel like you're more a part of that society. And so that's why we advocate for sport as a way to include people, because that undercuts the message of the extremists. You know, it undercuts them. The stuff that North Melbourne do, the Western Bulldogs, lots of other clubs have work in this area. Richmond with Bashar Hooley, Essendon. They've had a long history with engaging with multicultural communities, and the reason that they do that here in Melbourne is that sends a very powerful message to a young Muslim watching on TV, hearing somebody like Sonia Kruger talk about how, you know, Muslim immigration is bad, you know, we don't want your kind here. That's the message that sends. And then along comes the football club and says, you know, you're living in a room with several of your family who've just arrived from a conflict-ridden area. You can't do your homework. You know, come along to North Melbourne. We've got free tutors. We've got free Wi-Fi. And the tutors themselves are often volunteers.
You know, so that's happening.
At a place called The Huddle, which is partly funded by North Melbourne, partly funded by the Scanlon Foundation. And so that brings together international students who then get to talk about footy when they go back home, and they get a little reference for being a volunteer tutor from the club. Everyone wins, pretty much. And so they get a little bit more out of their stay in Australia. They get to volunteer as tutors for these kids. And the kids then look at it and say, well, okay, well, maybe there is a space for me here, you know. Maybe there's a space for me in this club, in this team, in this city, and in this country.
Yeah,
and
so that's a way in.
They've been doing that at a very systematic level. So it's for the past couple of years, and I've seen young kids from these communities, from Somalian communities in North Melbourne and Kensington, grow on to become leaders in their own right, because they've been awarded scholarships through North Melbourne, they've gone on to tertiary study, some of them are working either in AFL or in sports related areas, and it's just gotten to the stage where if you go to a footy match and you see somebody of African or Muslim background, chances are they're a North Melbourne supporter. So they've done that very well. So they've reached out to that community, and it's I mean, full credit to the club for not putting profits over above, you know, investing in the local community.
This is probably a question out of left field, but how do you think social activists should respond to something like the rise of the Pauline Hanson Nation Party? We don't quite know what to do. How should we respond?
Okay, the way they shouldn't respond is to call for voices like that to be silenced. That's the number one way that that won't work. What I think needs to happen is those voices need to be countered, acknowledging that Pauline Hanson has a right to have her opinion countered, and acknowledging to have her opinion heard, and acknowledging that she has the right to have her opinion heard doesn't mean that we don't counter that opinion.
Or argue against it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I think that's the most effective way to actually bring these types of voices out into the open. I've never supported the notion of far-right activists from Europe being banned from Australia. Let them come. Let them, you know, present their ideas. And then you know, let people from Australia then counter those ideas and say, well, we've done it differently here in Australia and it's worked, you know. And so have these views out in the open so that they can be countered. That's the whole idea of having a practicing and an open democracy. So, but I do think that on a political front, there certainly needs to be stronger condemnation of those views and stronger engagement of those views. And I think we saw the mistake that happened when John Howard didn't confront those views when Pauline Hanson was banging on about Asians back in the day. We sort of, that almost green-lighted it. Whereas if you see somewhere like Germany, you know, you see Angela Merkel staring some neo-Nazis in the face and saying, there's no space for you in Germany, you know, and that has an effect. It has a flow-on effect. It causes Germany's largest soccer teams to reach out to refugee communities. It causes German newspapers, you know, to write in support of taking in refugees from Syria. So
we need the leadership.
If the leadership takes a strong stand, then that tends to filter down.
I think probably this is a final question then. You know, you talked about how you sort of see diversity in Melbourne particularly. It's been quite a positive thing. But what more do we need to do, I suppose, to allow for a more diverse and more multicultural, that we're not doing now? How can we sort of allow it to happen more?
I think the next step is to reflect this in the media. If you go to somewhere like the United States, the lived experiences of people of colour might be worse. There's more racism on, you know, on ground level than in Australia. But in terms of media coverage, they've got that down pat because they've got quotas that state that the commercial media outlets have to portray, you know, the right amount of diversity to reflect what the composition of diversity in society. So you'll see, like, African-American women reporting on the Super Bowl on TV. You know, it's very difficult to see even female reporters, sports reporters, being treated with dignity in Australia. And so even though I think in Australia the lived experiences of migrants and people of colour is much better, the media doesn't reflect that.
That could be your next job, reporting. See you on TV doing sports reporting.
Yeah, the next stage, I guess, I think, is to stop the reflection of Australia as portrayed through Home and Away. You know, I think last year's, not that we should ever take reality TV as you know, educative or examples or anything like that, but last year I think they had like a completely monocultural bachelorette. You know, they had like three guys named Dave and they were all white. It's like you couldn't find any people of colour.
Well, there was a report during the week, I think, about that you know, the diversity in the media is still pretty low, isn't it?
I think that's the next stage to show that, okay, multiculturalism in Australia is reality, and so now we need to show that through the media and to portray that through the media.
Well, Nancy, thank you very much for sharing your ideas with us this afternoon. I hope we haven't worn you out before the forum, which sounds like being a very interesting
thing.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.